Ladies and gentlemen, yo! That's good. Okay. The topic for tonight is Mad Dog's Fables. Of course, we have to go through the traditional trademark thing. My lawyer is very careful to keep reminding me to say that Linux is a trademark of Linus Torvalds in this and other countries. Okay? Unix, of course, is a trademark of XOpen in several other countries. And Microsoft owns everything else. Now, the inspiration for this talk came from several different places. Number one, I definitely remember telling somebody at one time that I was thinking about coming to this conference. In fact, I was asked a couple times, are you coming to this conference? I said, yes, I think I might come to the conference. And so about a week ago, I decided to go to the website and actually decide to register, and then I saw that all the registrations were full. And I said, well, I feel kind of bad about that, but let's see what I'm missing. As I started to go down the page, I says, oh, great, Miguel's going to be there, you know, and Alan's going to be there and stuff, and Mad Dog's going to be there. And Mad Dog's giving a talk. Okay. But then I started to sweat, and I said to myself, what in the world can an old, what we call in Unix, an old fart, tell a bunch of people about Linux? I mean, every single one of you knows some good detail about Linux. I know overall lots of things, but on the other hand, I bore some portion, no matter what I talked about, with the Linux operating system. And then I started to think back a little bit to the time when I was in college. And when I was in college, we used to watch Star Trek every day. And I loved Star Trek. It was great. This is the original Star Trek, right? With all the paper mache mountains and stuff like that. And the paper boxes that look like a console and everything, you know. And James Kirk flying through the universe, you know, having sex with every alien on the face of the, or you know. And I really loved it until the one day that my two roommates joined me as we were sitting down to dinner to watch Star Trek. And it got to the end of the show. And, of course, everybody was dead except for Jim and Spock. And they said, here it comes. And I go, what? And they said, the moral, of course. And just as soon as they said it, sure enough, out of Jim's mouth came some moral about the whole episode. And that ruined the rest of Star Trek for me forever. And so tonight, I thought that instead of trying to talk about some issue of Linux or something like that, I would try and talk to you about things that I've learned over the last 31 years in computing. And I'm sure, just like everybody knows parables and those things, that you'll sit there and say, yeah, I knew that. But see, that's not the point. The point here is to bring it back from the backs of your consciousness into your forethought. The point here is to capsulize it so well that maybe you will then keep it in mind at some other time, either to help yourself or some other person. And so, let's take a little bit of trip back through 31 years of computing, and say, hey, this may not be new to me, but you somehow made it real, okay? Fable number one, all of my life's a circle. Everything I've seen, I've somehow seen before, only in a different way, shape, or form. I see computers go from small to large, to small to large, to small to large, to small to large, okay? And somehow we seem to be going back to the small space again. My very first computer I ever saw was an IBM 1130. And you could program it in any flavor of Fortran you wanted, as long as it's Fortran. In fact, we didn't even know about Fortran, you know, 77 or Fortran 90. It was just Fortran, okay? Because it was Fortran 1, but because people didn't know there was a Fortran 2 and a Fortran 4 and a Fortran 77 coming, they didn't call it Fortran 1, they just called it Fortran. In fact, in those days, it was all capital letters, Fortran. And somehow we've gotten to spell it mixed case now. I don't know why. But in any case, the IBM 1130 had 4,000 16-bit words of memory to it. It had a disk which was all of a megabyte in size. And that was huge, folks. Very huge. You used cards for the most part. You would sit down and you would type in your program and basically do a compile, link, and go every time you ran your card deck. Because there wasn't any real space to store your program on the disk. That was used for data and stuff like that. It had a little plotter attached to it, paper tape reader. But most importantly, it had sense switches across the console. If I move my little cursor here, those are the sense switches there. Of course, it had lights there. And the other thing about it was that the disk made grunting noises when you programmed it. And so what would happen is, you know, it's great not having a microphone, because I could come over here and talk too, you know. The thing was, you would go in there, and you would be running your program, and because it ran only one program at a time, it was very easy for you to tell when your program was going wrong. Because normally your program might sound like this. That was when it was doing fine. You turn off the lights, you can watch the little lights on the console and sit there, and all of a sudden your program would start going. Oh my God! Something's going wrong. And of course you would then stop your program to see if you could figure out what was going wrong and output all this big dump and start looking through your dump to see what was wrong. It was horrible. The sense switches were used for a very specific purpose. At least I use them for a very specific purpose, because one of my pet projects that I ran on this machine was a calendar production program that would produce these calendars. And maybe some of you have actually seen them if your father or something has, like, printouts, okay? Because this would be, like, you know, little dogs and cats, or maybe a woman sitting on a chair like this. And it was all done with ASCII characters. It was ASCII character art. Well, my addition to all of this was to combine every ASCII picture art I could see into one program and put a perpetual calendar on the bottom of it so that you could run this thing and every calendar would have the same year. That was one way it ran. It would have incrementing years, and so you could generate whole bunches of different calendars. And I remember one time running off calendars every year from the year 1968 to the year 1974, because after all, there was nothing that came after 1974. Well, the thing is, if your boss came into the room while you were running this program, you catch all sorts of flack about using the computer system for something that wasn't productive. And so what you would do is you would also write the program so that when you flipped one of those sense switches, it would all of a sudden start doing something else. And start printing off something else in the plotter, you know, like something that looked like just reams of data coming out from the production lines or something. And your boss would walk in and say, what are you doing? You mumble something about, you know, numerical analysis and things like that. Oh, that's good. And wander away and you flip the sense switch back and start printing out more calendars. So that was very useful. The sense switches were very useful. Now, my second computer system was actually one I used in the university, because by that time I had gotten hooked on computers. It was a PDP-8. And there you didn't really talk about bytes as such, because actually it was actually a 6-bit byte. That was because you had ASR33 teletype as your input and output device, which only could produce capital letters anyway. But if you did have something that could produce different case letters, you had a shift character that would shift you into a different case. So you say shift into the next case, and it would go like lowercase, and then you would do lowercase characters and shift, and then you do uppercase characters. That's why you only needed a 6-bit byte. Therefore, the word length of 12 bits could actually hold 2 characters. It had all of 8 different registers. It only had one real register. That was an accumulator, and all input and output went through that register. Now, I'd like to point out the fact that this little computer, which actually sat on a desktop, only used 780 watts for its 4K of memory, and the price of it was only $18,000. Let me put this in perspective for you. In 1965, my parents bought a three-bedroom house on a quarter acre of land in Baltimore, Maryland, with an attached garage, a back porch, screened in, you know, dining room, recreation room, kitchen, all that type of stuff, for the grand total of $29,000. So for only about half of the price of the house, plus a little more, you too could own a PDPA computer. The third type of computer system I worked on, there's a reason I'm going through all these. There's the third type of computer I worked on was actually at my first real job, and that was an IBM 360, 370 class computer system, which belonged to Aetna Life and Casualty. They had a 3-acre computer center, which was down in the bowels of their building. Of course, you could never go into the computer center because this was back during the 1960s, late 60s, and they were quite afraid of people blowing it up. And so the only way you could get in through there was two sliding doors that would slide apart when you ran your badge through the badge reader. Then there was another set of sliding doors that would also part as you went through. But the reason the second doors parted was because there was a guard sitting in between the two sets of doors who would flip a little switch when they recognized who you were. And therefore, it took both sets of doors to be opened in order for you to roll a bomb in through the two doors to blow up the computer center. I still remember in 1974, the CEO of Aetna Life and Casualty, the largest multi-line insurance company in the world, which had at that time, I believe, 40,000 people to the company, and 4,000 of those were programmers, systems administrators, and so forth, sending out a paper memo to every single person in the corporation saying, "We have just bought the second megabyte of main memory for our computer system." Now today, if a CEO sent out a piece of paper to anybody saying we bought another megabyte of memory for our computer system, they would wrap a straitjacket around that poor person and cart them off. That shows how much memory cost back in those days. As far as graphics back in those days, for the most part, was still printing out calendars in ASCII format. A lot of that going on. Now, about that same time, mini computers were really starting to come in. Digital Equipment Corporation, Prime, and Data General, all were making mini computers. IBM was making mini computers. And the memories prices started to drop. The prices of the system started to drop. But to give you an idea, in 1980, I bought a megabyte of main memory for a Max 11780, and it only cost me $23,000. The computers kept getting smaller, and then about the time of 1977, microcomputers started to come in. You started to get things like the Altair MITS computer. You started to get computers you could actually build out of kits. And I did build one of those computers out of kits. It was using a Cosmac RCA 1802 microprocessor. It had a full complement of 16 kbytes of memory that you could buy at 4 kbytes at a time. Each one of those 4 kbytes cost you $400. The entire cost of my little computer system with its 12 kbytes of memory was about $1,600. To put this in perspective, about the same year, I bought a Toyota pickup truck for $5,000. Most of the computer systems back in those days could use 64K of memory. And now a lot of the people in this room are beginning to say, "Oh yes, 64K, that's the Z80 processor, that's the 8088 processor, so forth, you're beginning to come into the time frame. About the same time, I go out to Palo Alto, California. I start working with some engineers out there. And the big question comes, what is the difference between a workstation and a PC? Well, workstations use machines that can do virtual memory with demand page virtual memory. They ran this operating system called Unix. And PCs were these rather little weak, ineffective boxes that ran this thing called DOS. And I kept saying to my engineers, you know, you keep talking about workstations and selling workstations at the prices that you're selling them, and yet PCs keep becoming stronger and stronger and more efficient. They keep having more and more features, a lot like a workstation. And it was the same cycle going through again, that the thing that had started off as having a very low memory and being relatively weak was gaining in strength, gaining in capabilities. And now, just when we think it's safe, just when everybody can afford a gigabyte of memory on their system, or, you know, you can have 2 700 megahertz processors on your system, 2, why not 8, okay? All of a sudden, we start coming back, and we start thinking about embedded systems. And no longer can we simply waste a couple of megabytes of memory on, Alan, it was today you said you can afford to put 2 megabytes of memory for your video card, right? Not in an embedded system. Costs too much when you're making 100,000 of them in a shot. That's $1 million you could save. The process is, it keeps coming around. You know, we're always in the process of trying to make things smaller and better. There's another portion about this. It's not just the hardware that keeps cycling like this. Back in the early days of computers, and in microcomputers, in fact, in the early days of computers in general, it was a very small community. We felt that we were doing something that was really great, bringing in computers. Then in the days of microprocessors, again, it became another very small community. And here, I think we have yet another very small community, the Linux community. And just like Ken Britton felt in the Homebrew Computer Club, that somehow we were subversives. We were going in to do something that nobody had done before, in the strength that nobody had done before, we're actually doing it again. There's been other things that have come around. All the different projects that people said, this is going to be the end-all, be-all project. USL versus OSF. I think it went back. I think I may have hit it twice there. Nope, that won't do it. USL versus OSF. The ACE project. How many of you remember ACE? Yes, ACE was a bunch of companies getting together and saying, we're going to create the operating system that goes across all platforms. Ironically, one of those companies was Microsoft. Yes, Olivetti. Well, Digital, SCO, there's a whole bunch of them. There's these cycles of things going on. And so the moral of Fable 1 is, if you think you haven't seen it before, just wait a moment, and it'll happen again. Hopefully this will happen again, too. Uh-oh. Same way from Applix here. Oh, come on. Pardon me? I know I'm in drawing mode now. Let's try this again. There we go. Fable 2. The hare in the testing lab. Now, when I was back at Aetna Life and Casualty, we had a whole series of people who were programmers. And you sat up there in your laboratories and stuff like that, programming away. And from time to time, you would have to have a tape mounted or something. We would send a message down, to, you know, from the terminal, CP message to operator, please mount a tape. Well, after a while, I'm not really stupid. After a while, I began to realize that this message you were sending down to this operator was a little bit too complex for a program to parse. Therefore, there must be a human being at the other end who is actually doing some of this stuff. After a while, I began to become a little bit friendly with these human beings. And I found out that there were certain things they would do to people that they were not friendly with. Things like stupid card tricks. If you were sitting down to a key punch machine, key punches, when you key punch the card, would print across the top of the card what you were key punching. Therefore, when you were looking at your deck afterwards to find the problem, you could look at the top, find the card that matched up, and correct the problem on the card. If you really didn't like the person who was sitting at the key punch machine, you would distract them momentarily and have somebody slide a card into the key punch machine, which had a hole punched in it with no printing at the top. And so when they used this card in their program, they would then run it through the compiler. The compiler would say, this character is bad, but when they looked at the card, unless they could read the columns, they wouldn't know. All that was printed at the top was what they expected to be printed at the top. It would take them hours to debug this process. Then, of course, there was simply the facility of dropping the deck. If you didn't like the person who submitted the deck to you, all 4,300 cards of it, you would simply drop it. And because there were no numbers along the right-hand side that would tell you what order these cards are supposed to be in, because nobody ever did that, you would then have these cards that this person would have to put back into order, which would take them several hours or maybe even days. Or you could actually do something nice and something else in the card deck. When they ran through the compiler, because compilers of those days would come out with really nice error statements like, error in line 4,098 of your program. The only problem was your program is only 300 cards long. And that was because something had gone wrong. The compiler just could not tell what was wrong, and therefore the only error message it would come out with is error in line 4,098. Well, the operators knew all of these things that caused this little problem. And so all they had to do was introduce this into your card deck, and you spent hours trying to figure out what was wrong. That was the operators. There's another group of people that we don't always give the credit to and the attention to that we should. And these are the QA people, the people that do testing of the stuff that we generate. Okay. And a lot of times these people are the most overworked and least appreciated of all the people in an organization. I was working with a QA group one time. We were about to go to field test with our software. And it was field test software that had never been on the field test hardware. The only people that had put the field test software on the field test hardware were the software engineers in the first place. I very desperately wanted to put the real software on the real hardware before we went to field test, erase it off the machines, and then send the machines out so we could figure out whether the machines failed before they shipped or during shipment. It took almost an act of God to have this happen. But when it did happen, we found out that 7 out of the 15 machines that had been produced in manufacturing actually failed before they left the company. The reason they failed was that the QA people had been told by the engineers, at least they thought they'd been told by the engineers, if the software fails in, you know, on this system, don't worry about it. What they've actually been told by the engineers is, if the software fails with this specific error message, don't worry about it, because we know that there's a problem with the diagnostics. And consequently, through a lack of communication, we could have had a disastrous field test. Another time we were looking at testing was when the engineers had written some documentation. The documentation people had put it into a manual, and they were now testing the validity of the manual with the hardware. We had a mirror set up, two-way mirror set up. We had people photographing the field testing people. The people were sitting there, and it was two people trying to install the software in the system. And in the background, you saw the engineer who had actually written the documentation. The documentation said, take the floppy disk and stick it in the slot in the front of the machine. The problem was that one of the engineering people thought that the slot looked very ugly, and so they covered it over with a plastic plate that was now closed. The people sitting there reading this documentation could not see any slot except the little space in between the front panel of the machine and the top of the machine. Because this was a prototype, the front panel didn't come all the way up to the top. And so sitting there, they said, maybe this is where. And they slid the floppy disk into the slot, and it fell down on the CPU and almost instantly melted. The videotape is still going. The engineer in the back of the room takes his notebook, which he's been taking down notes, throws it up in the air, and walks out of the room while the two people are still saying, it doesn't look right. The thing is that we can always generate more code and more things than a testing lab could ever possibly test. And this brings about the last little bullet on this part of Fable. Dilbert. How many of you do not read Dilbert? How many of you do not know what Dilbert is? Do not read, no. How many of you don't read Dilbert? Don't. You really should. Okay? The thing is that everybody thinks that Dilbert, of course, is just a cartoon. It is not. It is reality. And in this particular cartoon I'm talking about, the pointy-haired boss comes up and says, oh, I'm sorry, Dilbert comes up and says to the pointy-haired boss, the hardware doesn't work, the software is terrible, there's no documentation for it, we're supposed to be shipping this next week, what should we do? And the pointy-haired boss says, maybe we should ship it anyway and hope that somebody writes a dummies book about it. That is, you know, that's what a lot of people think is going to happen, and unfortunately, it does not. And so the morals of Fable 2 are, be kind to your operators and QA people, your documentation people. These people are just, or in a lot of cases, maybe even more important than you, and they can make your life hell, or they can make your life great. And finally, if it isn't tested, it ain't. And the corollary to that is, if it isn't documented, it ain't either. Fable number three. I said operators. Fable number three, the angry engineer and their characteristics. One of the characteristics of engineers, I've noticed this, these engineers I've dealt with, is you walk up to them and you say, I'd really like to have this. The first word out of their mouth is, it's impossible. This happened to me when I was trying to get it to better the installation of the first version of Unix that Digital shipped, called Ultrix. I took, you know, back in those days when you installed Ultrix and or BSD, it was like installing some of the very early versions of Linux. You had to basically type in every type of component you had so that you can then build the kernel so that you can then run the system. And the thing, of course, these devices didn't have any reasonable names to them, like, you know, terminal port or anything like that. It was always RSX-11-RJ25-C, okay, which nobody knew that was the name of it unless you pulled the thing out of the computer and looked at it. On the other hand, there's these operating systems called VMS and RSX-11 that could probe the bus and find out where these things are. And I asked the engineers, I said, why can't you get Unix to do that? And they said, can't be done. Unix is a completely different kernel than all the rest of these, can't be done. And I say, well, that's too bad. So I went back to my office. I found a diagnostic tape that was used to diagnose the hardware, that it also could probe the bus. I ran the tape. I got the output. I stuck it through an awk program, which then produced a configuration file like Berkeley would use. And I went back to the engineer and said, why can't you do this? This is all I'm asking, is that you run this program, have it output this, and create the configuration file. And the engineer's eyes got about this big. And he says, I'll see what I can do. And he went away for, you know, I went away for about a day and a half, and he came back and pulled me into his cubicle and says, look at this. He had taken the Pascal program, because it was written in Pascal, ran through the Pascal to C converter, and basically built that into the installation facility, and now Ultrix could do a self-configuration. So it was impossible, I learned, meant that it's going to take us at least 2 days. I've also noticed that there are some engineers who have never learned to say the word, I was wrong. I learned this very early in my life, okay? It's very easy for me now to say the words, I was wrong. I've done it millions of times. But one of the engineers I first met who couldn't say this was a boss of mine in the early days, and one time I actually trapped him to the point where he could not recognize, you know, he was definitely wrong. He could not get out of it. And he came up to me and he said, John, John, he says, I was, I says, go ahead, Tom. Go ahead and say it. You're about to say, I was wrong, aren't you? Go ahead and say it, Tom. You can do it. Come on, boy. I was, you were right.
I said, Tom, you are sick. You should go to somebody.
There was a friend of mine who was the architect for Digital Unix for a long time. I won't tell you his name because some of you know him, but he's a really good guy in a lot of respects. But again, he just can't lose an argument. He has to win the argument. Okay? And one time, I went to him and I said, hey, there's this thing called Linux. It's really good. You should try it out. I heard about it. It's a toy operating system. Not useful. Some time goes past. I actually get a couple good copies of Linux. I take it. I put it on his chair. A couple weeks go past. I see him in the hallway. I says, hey, how'd you like the Linux? I put it on my laptop. Got it running. Didn't think too much of it. I took it off. Windows is back there. Now, I mean, this is this guy's right, okay? I mean, not everybody has to like Linux. I can understand that. And so, okay, it didn't meet his needs. I can understand that, too. On the other hand, about 2 weeks later, I was over in Europe giving a course, and I ran into this guy's boss. And I happened to mention Linux to him. And he says, oh, yeah, this guy raves about it. Says the best thing since sliced bread. Says that we should be learning something from the Linux people. I says, really? He hasn't said anything like that to me. Oh, he talks about it all the time in meetings and stuff. Okay. So I went back to the office, right? Saw this guy in the hallway. I says, been doing anything more with Linux? No. So, you know, I say, okay, this is a game he's playing. I'm not going to play the game. But then, about a year later, I'm giving a talk at the University of New Hampshire. And at the end of the talk, this guy comes up to me. And he says, it's one of the students. Comes up to me and he says, hi, he says, I've been using Linux for a couple of years and it's really good. My father brought it home from work. He says, he works at Digital too. He says, do you know him? And I was just about to start into my, well, there's 130,000 people at Digital talk, you know, and I can't know all of them. He says, his name is, it's the same guy. Now I have him.
So I go, next time I see him, I go back to the office, next time I see him in the lab, in the cafeteria, I walk up to him and says, hi, I met your son yesterday at a Linux meeting.
He goes, all right, I admit it.
Just, that kid, he says, I bought him a brand new computer for school, you know, all this memory, all this disk space. First thing he did was rip Windows, all that, put Linux on it. I'll admit it. And it's okay as an operating system. Is that what you wanted?
Of course, we started off this with a comparison of how computers kept getting larger and larger memories and things like that. But part of that process is that while memory is getting longer, larger, and even cache is getting larger, it isn't always the fact that it's unlimited. David Mossberger Tang, one of the people who worked on the Alpha Linux project, did a study one time that taking two very large arrays and multiplying them against each other, just the same way that somebody who taking linear algebra had done, and he found out that it ran at a certain speed. But by taking the second array and inverting it, doing the multiplication, and then inverting the answer, it allowed the second array to stay in cache more, and he found out that it could run over 40 times faster. He thought, well, maybe this is just because of the alpha, because it's a deep cache. But then again, he found out that by additional work, that even on an Intel system, it ran 10 times faster by being able to take advantage of the cache.
Going back to the impossible statements, we had the engineers take one of our earlier versions of OSF, and we wanted to shrink it down because it had been using over 64 megabytes of memory just to boot. And this was a little bit too much, particularly when memory was still costing about $1,000 a megabyte or so. And we decided to make it smaller. And they did get it down to booting in 24 megabytes of memory, and running very well in 32. But the more surprising thing was that the whole operating system ran about 7% faster. And again, it was because more things tended to stay in the cache because all the data structures were smaller and you could get more things to stay in the cache. One of my bosses, because of the small memory size in the early days, was utilizing a byte out of every 32-bit address that the IBM 370 had. Back in those days, the IBM 370 computers had a 24-bit address space, and they could access about 16 megabytes of virtual memory. On every single instruction, on every single place that mentioned addresses, there was always this little byte at the end with these slash marks through it that said, reserved for future use. My boss would use those bytes to hold little bytes of data. And I would say to him, you know, Tom, someday IBM's going to come along, and they're going to start to use that. He says, by the time they do that, I'll be dead and gone. He died the next year. Every single one of his programs he'd ever written had to go back and be changed so that IBM could then come out with their 32-byte virtual address. I'm sorry, 4-byte virtual address. Memories and CPUs are cheap, but I keep telling people, too, that if you're going to learn computer science, you have to know your machine and the machine language.
One time, I was given a project of taking a program that ran in 15 hours and try and make it run in a smaller period of time. Basically, the only change I had to make to that program was to make the buffer size larger than it was writing out to magnetic tapes. Because back in those days, you had start-stop magnetic tapes, and the magnetic tapes are being written at a rate of about 9,600 bits per inch along the linear aspect of the tape. So what you would have is you start to write a block, and then you would have a 3/4 inch in the record gap. That was the time it took for the tape drive to slow down, come to a complete stop, and then to start up again, get up to speed to write the next block of data. If you blocked the block of data, as a lot of people did, with one card image per block, that meant you had 3/4 inch of inner record gap, 1/20 inch of data, 3/4 inch of inner record gap, all the way along the tape. And the tape drive had to come to a complete halt before the next block was read or written. So the tape would go, one particular job created 14 output tapes and took 15 hours a night to read them in. I changed the blocking factor of it to block 100 logical records per block. And so now you had a considerable amount of data. I think it's about 4 inches of data with a 1/4 inch of inner record gap, 3/4 inch of inner record gap. And it went from running 15 hours a night to running 5 hours a night. Now, why would a person write a program like that? It's because they had never really seen what the tape drive was writing, was doing. They had never really seen what was being put on the tape. Their idea of computing was to sit at a console in another room, write their program. These same people would write COBOL programs that would store the index to an array as an EBCDIC character. Now, the two slowest instructions in the entire IBM instruction set was take EBCDIC character, convert it to packet decimal. That was the first step. Take packet decimal character, convert it to binary. That was the second step. So this person, in order to increment their array by 1 pointer, would have to do two of the slowest instructions, increment the array, and then convert them back to store it as an EBCDIC character. Again, because they did not understand what the architecture of the machine was doing. We had a program at Hartford State Technical College where I was teaching, which took 1,206 32-byte records. It took the EDD1170 10.5 hours to sort those 1,206 records at 32 bytes. I could have sorted them faster by typing them on the punch cards, throwing them up in the air, and then picking them up on the floor in the proper order. When I looked at this program, the person who had written it had done every conceivable thing wrong. They could not possibly have done more wrong if they had tried. Okay. Number one, they used a bubble sort. Number two, they never checked to see if the array was sorted properly in the first place. Number three, they always went through every single comparison on every single pass. And number four, they never tested along the way to see, have I ever flipped any of the entries to see whether, okay, maybe now it's sorted. To sort 1,206 records took over 13 million comparisons. And because the array was too big to fit into the memory of the PDP-1170, it had to access the four disk, RPU6, 700,000 times. And it did that whether or not the array was sorted properly in the first place. Okay? So I took one of my students aside, because at the school we were in the union and we could not write programs for the school. I took one of my students aside and said, I'm going to teach you some things. I'm going to teach you recursive reentrant programming, and I'm going to teach you a tree sort and a sort merge. And he wrote the first part of it, which was to pull the file apart into 7 parts, so each
part of the file committed to memory at one time, and he wrote a recursive tree build program, which, as you probably realize, would only take about 2 or 3 lines of basic code, but we were running it. And he went, "Mr. Hall, I'm about to run it." So I came in, he said, "Run," and he came back and said, "Ready." And he goes, "Shit." And I go, "What's wrong?" He says, "It didn't work." I said, "How do you know it didn't work?" He says, "It came back too fast." I said, "Let's take a look at it." And with Basic Plus and Vistas, you can actually walk through the memory doing interactive debugging in Basic, and you can actually see the tree built. And the kid goes, "Oh my God, oh my God." I says, "Yes, that's right. You don't know how fast it can really be, because you've always been doing things, interacting with the hardware, like disk and stuff like that. You get it all up into memory and see how much faster it is.
Get rid of a lot of the overhead." The boss, who I told you, had used that last quarter, that last byte of each address. He built a microcomputer also, put it together in kit 4. When he got it all together, he called me over his house because he wanted some help there in case something went wrong. He fired it up. Everything was fine. Back in those days, your editor, your assembler, your debugger, and your source code for your program, and the object code for your program, all sat in main memory at one time. Because the only peripherals you had were things like little tape drives that made squeaking sounds at your computer, which you then would interpret as ones and zeros. So he typed in his program, and he said, "Assemble." And the screen flickered for a fraction of a second. And he said, "Damn, it didn't work." I says, "How do you know it didn't work?" He goes, "The screen only flickered for a second and stopped." I said, "Let's lose your debugger, look through memory." There was this object code. Again, he hadn't considered how fast the microprocessor would really be when he got rid of the peripherals. He was too used to an IBM mainframe where he was fighting for CPU power with 14 or 15 other people. The moral of Fable 3, it takes more than just a good programmer and a good architect. You have to be a good person in order to be a good engineer. Fable 4, the king has no clothes. People believe what you tell them.
So many people have been saying Microsoft has been good for so long that some people actually believe them. Recently, it was discovered on the internet, I don't know how many of you know this, that Linux is actually now, if you search with Alta Vista, Linux now actually appears more than the word Microsoft. But what's really interesting is both of them appear more than the word sex. Personally, I find that frightening. We in the Linux and Unix community have this slight problem. We like to position our operating system as the operating system for thinking people. Unfortunately, this also comes back to bite us because then we have a lot of people who think that using Linux is really hard. And I quite frankly think that today, given the GUI interfaces we have, like KDE and GNOME, that Linux is at least as easy to use as Windows was 2 or 3 years ago, if not easier. For one thing, it doesn't keep crashing work. And I think that adds a certain amount of element. If Linux was pre-installed on every computer the way that Windows is today, that would take away a lot of people's angst about Linux. It really would. And if we had VARs who integrated in Office products like StarOffice and AppleSquare and Corel products and things like that, and then pre-install this on a system, it would create even less angst for people. The problem is that we have this little pride inside of ourselves that we're using a very sophisticated operating system. And again, this brings about the cartoon of Dilbert, where they were having the operating system wars to choose their operating system. And one person came in and represented one operating system. They had on a beret and a monocle, and of course he was a Macintosh. And then the next day, they had this other cartoon where there was this guy who is Wally on Gilbert Strand. Wally is sitting there and going, you, that beard, those sandals, the suspenders, you must be one of those condescending Unix users. And this person who's standing there, and I hate to say this, but he looks a lot like me, holding out a nickel that says, here, son, take a dip and go buy yourself a real operating system. And this is a problem that we have in the Linux community. We have to get over this, okay? How many of you know how Unix actually got onto a PDP-11 from the PDP-7 if it was first put on? How many of you know that? How many know the story behind that? That's good enough. I'll tell you anyway. Unix, as you know, was first done in assembly language on a PDP-7 in Bell Laboratories. But after a while, the PDP-7 began to run out of steam. And so, Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie wanted to buy a PDP-11. Unfortunately, their portion of the lab didn't have the money to do that. And so they went to the only place inside of Bell Laboratories that was absolutely guaranteed to have enough money to be able to buy a very expensive computer. That was the legal department. And this is one of the reasons why Unix has so many commands in it which are textually based. Think about it. Ref, off, cat. They're all textually based. And they all fit together very nicely. This was done as a promise to these lawyers that they would be able to take this machine with this new operating system and be able to do the legal briefs on them. Now, I want to present you with what I think is a pretty interesting situation. A whole bunch of lawyers sitting around using Unix. And not Emacs or VI, but ED to do their briefs on it. Okay? And this is why in Bell Labs that derived this very intelligent group of people who were there to help the lawyers, and they were called legal secretaries. And these people learned to program Unix and use the text editors and use the textual things to do their work. Again, they weren't told that Unix was hard to use. They were told that Unix was built for them. And therefore, they went ahead and used it. There's a time in history where Sun Microsystems was basically pushing Unix very hard. And they said, Unix is the wave of the future. It is the open system. After a period of time, the term open systems, or a term, started to be applied to Microsoft products. It really did. Microsoft was open because you could buy it in any store. It went on lots of people's hardware and stuff like that. Unix became to be known as proprietary because each vendor had their own version. And therefore, you didn't buy a proprietary Unix system. You'd buy open Microsoft. It was an S-tier. But around that time, the different Unix vendors were also trying to sell Unix as being able to do everything. Let me take you back in time again. Unix back in those days did not have symmetrical multiprocessing. It was not high availability. It didn't do a lot of the things that a lot of the proprietary systems did at that time. And therefore, one CEO of a company said the magic words, those Unix people are selling Unix just like a snake oil salesman sells snake oil. In the old kind of shows, you have a snake oil salesman hold up a bottle of medicine and say, buy my medicine, it cures every ill, it does everything, it never rusts, it never busts, you use it, shine as your mother. That's the way that people are selling Unix. This CEO was saying that you shouldn't be selling it that way. As this relate to Linux, we have to be careful that we do not oversell Linux to a particular person or particular have to make sure that that person's use of Linux can feasibly be done. Because if they try Linux one time, they can't do what they want to do. It'll be very hard to get them back and do that again next time.
The moral of Fable 5, don't tell them what you don't want them to think. Fable 6, management knows what it's doing.
At one time I worked for Bell Laboratories, a group of very, very intelligent engineers, okay? The problem that Bell Laboratories had at that time was that it'd take a very intelligent engineer and promote them to be a supervisor. The engineer had to know how to program, the engineer knew how to debug, the engineer knew how to build things.
And this one about
a friend of mine who got promoted, and was a great guy, truly brilliant, and he was promoted to supervisor. All of a sudden, we noticed that Ed went out to lunch and wouldn't come back for lunch. Then after a while, Ed was going out to lunch at 10 o'clock and not coming back. Then there were some days Ed wouldn't show up at all. And sure enough, Ed developed this drinking problem. Bell Labs is very good. They sent him to a sanitarium, they got him dried out, they came back, everybody was happy. This lasted for about 2 months, and started not showing up again. Bell Labs was, you know, a bunch of very intelligent people. After the second sanitarium visit, they said to Ed, Ed, what is wrong? And Ed said, oh my God, it's terrible being the supervisor. All these people come into my office, and they always wait an answer. And they stay there waiting for an answer. And I don't know the answer. And it's driving me crazy. And poor Ed didn't really realize that it was perfectly okay for a supervisor to say, I don't know. Or, give me some time to think about it. You know, go away. And I'll come back in a day or two. Maybe I'll have some thoughts. Or, you know, let me think about it as well. He thought that because he was a supervisor, he had to have the answer right then. Never be given the
challenge or the training to let him know that. On the other hand of the line, there was another supervisor there who was a mechanical engineering supervisor who was put in charge of a bunch of systems administrators. And he tried to apply his thought process in mechanical engineering to everything in computer science. This didn't work out either. And eventually, we kind of drove him out. No, just driving him crazy, basically. That is, so part of the story behind this, part of the paper behind this is, if you're going to do that type of thing of promoting your engineers, please either give them or allow them to take the training that they need to be good supervisors. The management will say they know the marketplace, and they've done all sorts of forecasts.
This is interesting to me because in reality, just like things keep coming around, things keep changing also. We're in a global marketplace now. There's never been a marketplace like this before in the world. There will never be a marketplace like this again in the world. The world is moving fast, so forward so fast now, that the lessons that we learned last year and the year before don't necessarily apply today. When I was in college, if you bought a dozen long-stem roses, it probably would send you back about a week's salary, at least a week from college to the week. Today, you go out on the road and you buy the same dozen long-stem roses for about $10 U.S. How can you do this? Well, they don't grow long-stem roses in the United States. They grow them in Mexico. And there's large rose-growing plantations down there. It costs 2 cents to grow the rose, 2 cents to pick the rose using automated pickers, 2 cents to ship the rose to the bottom of a Boeing 747 in the United States, and then to distribute them to these people who sell them alongside the rose. global economy. This is the economy we're going towards. But management is using worse forecasting than memory management units that only do least recently used. Don't sweat the small stuff. Again, Dilbert. There's a book that Scott Adams has put out. And in it, he talks about the OA5 theory. The out at five. Basically, if you go into work, you do your best, and you're working really hard, you should be able to leave the office at 5 o'clock. If your management... If your management consistently keeps loading you down with work, consistently, so you don't have time to do anything else, you're consistently in there at 11, 12 o'clock at night, there's something wrong. I had a friend of mine who, for 11 years, had been going to school at night to get his bachelor's degree. He finally was within about a course of getting his bachelor's degree, and he came to me and he said, "Mad Dog, I have this chance that if I take these other courses for another year, I'll be able to get a master's degree at the same time I get my bachelor's degree. What do you think I should do?" And I said, "Tom, you have kids who are 11, 12, and 13 years old. You take this, of course, it takes you a year or two more at night to get your master's degree, and your kids are going to be out of the house. They're going to be driving cars, they're going to be with their friends and everything. You've lost your chance to really get to know them. On the other hand, if you do get your master's degree, you've been in the industry for 20 years, what is that going to do for you? How many people are going to say, 'Well, I'm going to hire you because you got your master's degree,' when you didn't, as opposed to not having it after 20 years of experience?" And he goes, "I think you're right." He took the first option of getting his bachelor's degree, and now he's actually getting some chance to spend time with his kids. I have in my back three herniated discs. They're created through stress. I'm not actually a basketball player. I don't live heavy options. In fact, I have other people live with. But stress is a killer. And for a long time, I would let things get me very, very stressed out. Now I've learned that basically it's not worth it. That stress is a killer. And so now I take the attitude, I do the best I possibly can. If anybody wants anything better than that, that's their problem, not mine. So the morals of Fable 6, good engineers don't necessarily make good managers. Typically, good managers make really horrible engineers. Don't let your manager engineer the stuff unless they actually show good engineering talent, okay? Don't just smell the roses. Try growing them. All of you are at a point in your lives right now where you've got to make the decision of what you're going to do. And if you're married, if you have kids, stuff like that, that's a good decision. And finally, help the newbies of today. When I started off, all you needed was a Fortran deck and a card punch. Maybe some new cards. You didn't have to know about networking. You didn't have to know about X. You didn't have to know about standards. You didn't have to know about, a lot of things, SMP, none of that stuff. Today, just to get started, you have to know so much is actually frightening. And the other side is frightening. There's a bunch of these kids who are now 13, 14, 15 years old. It's not frightening that they study computer science and they know it, and they're really good. What's frightening is it's all-consuming for them. That's frightening. How many of you have read about Napster and our friend who is producing it? In fact, he says that he locks himself in a room and that's the only thing he does. He used to play baseball and basketball and stuff like that. He doesn't do anything else. That's frightening.
Philosophies of Unix and Linux. You're fairly familiar with these. Small is beautiful. Don't reinvent the wheel. A shell program in the hand is worth a C program in the bush. And then prototype. And after you finish prototyping, you're probably done. But if you really want to, then you can code up a C program.
Ken Thompson has actually said that. When they asked Linus, I said, how'd you decide, you know, how to build your operating system in the first place? He goes, well, I could have developed a completely new operating system, but it was really easier to make one that was compatible with what was written, that the port to 35,000 applications. The last one, of course, he's gotten into incredible trouble with Tuve about, so...
Don't say anything. So finally, my thanks to a whole series of people here who have allowed me to be here tonight. You know, I go to a lot of conferences and things like that, but I really, really enjoy coming to a conference like this.
Number one, because I can actually sit down in a session every once in a while and learn something interesting. But number two, because I really get to be and interact with all the people like you. You are the people that make Linux work and make Linux go forward. So, thank you very much.